Well, good afternoon to one and all, and I want to welcome you to this event, which is going to be focusing on the impact of the Ebola pandemic. My name is Fred Logevall, and I am a faculty member in the history department here at Cornell. I'm also serving as vice provost for international affairs, and I'm here really in my capacity as director of the Mario Einaudi Center for International Studies. A particular welcome to our guests, who will be introduced in a moment. And I want to just make a couple of points before we begin. Obviously, the subject matter of our session this afternoon is a most serious one. We have currently, I believe, 13,268 total cases of Ebola. This is according to the most recent statistics, at least that I've seen from the World Health Organization. The virus has reached some 8 countries, I believe, to this point. And I think there's a broad consensus, certainly among experts, that the pandemic has brought immense damage, not only to the health and social welfare of the affected countries, needless to say, but also to the mining, agriculture, and service industries globally, as investors evacuate foreign workers, as borders close, and international flights are suspended, in some cases canceled. And the political repercussions, I don't have to say to any of you, have been very large indeed. So it's, we think, an opportune moment to come together in this room with a panel of experts to talk about these implications. It's an honor for me to have an opportunity to welcome all of you and to just say a few words. I want to say, in addition, that this is an event that is jointly organized by the Institute for African Development and the Einaudi Center, that it's part of the Einaudi Center's roundtable discussion series that features experts in international affairs who can address topics that are of great international consequence. And it's also part of our Einaudi Center Foreign Policy Forum. We have received very grateful support, I want to indicate, from the Bartels family. So this roundtable series really wouldn't be possible without the support that the Bartels, who have been so generous to the Einaudi Center in so many different ways, and to Cornell as well, that we wouldn't be able to do this without what the Bartels family has brought. We have, as I indicated, a very distinguished panel here to talk about this, and I want to invite now, it's my great pleasure to invite to you, Cornell Professor Muna Ndulo, who's a distinguished professor in the law school here at Cornell, and he is also the director of the Institute for African Development. Muna is going to moderate today's event. We're going to be going, I believe, until 6 o'clock. Muna is very much in charge, and he is now going to introduce the event and also introduce our panel members. Muna. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Fred. Thank you for coming and for finding time to be with us. I know how busy you are, so thanks. I would like to join Fred in welcoming you to this roundtable on social, economic, and political impacts of the Ebola epidemic. As has been mentioned, the roundtable is organized by the Mario Einaudi Center for International Studies in collaboration with the Institute for African Development. We have 4 eminently qualified persons to address the issues presented by this topic. But before we proceed, I would like to make a few remarks and also first begin by thanking Ms. Heike Michelsen and Ms. Jackie Sayer for organizing this event. They worked very hard to make this event possible, so thank you. Now, I would also like to make a few observations about the topic that we are going to be dealing with today. The Economist, in one of his recent reports that in September 1976, a scientist in Antwerp received 2 thermos out of Yabuku in what district in what was then called Zaire, with two samples from a nun who was fatally ill. The scientists discovered that they were dealing with a deadly unknown virus. They named the virus Ebola, after the river in Yabuku district in the Congo, where this sample had come from. Now, between 1976 and 2014, there have been actually 20 Ebola epidemics, each in a small village or town. These epidemics claimed a total of 300 lives, and these epidemics were contained fairly quickly. One of the questions, of course, that arises today is whether the international community ignored lessons they should have learned from the way these communities dealt with those epidemics. Today's crisis is of a different order. It has stricken three countries, Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone, with a combined population of 20 million. It has killed over 4,500 people, and cases have been reported, spread by medical personnel in several other countries, including the US, Nigeria, Spain, Switzerland. And on August 8, the World Health Organization declared Ebola an international public health emergency. WHO called it the most severe acute public health emergency in modern times. Following on to this, I think we should try and focus on some of the issues that actually this whole crisis presents. As has been mentioned, the crisis in terms of the challenges cuts across disciplines. As Tandika Mkandawire recently observed in front of an audience of over 1,000 scientists, he paraphrased George Clemenceau's famous quip that war is too important to be left to generals. And he suggested that health is too important to be left to health practitioners alone. Like in most responses to humanitarian disasters that are mounted by the international community, the Ebola response is focused too narrowly on the technical aspects, one can argue, of containing a problem, and too little on the underlying social and political reasons why the problem has been allowed to fester in the first place. It has also shown us that fear and suspicion has spread faster than the virus. The South African ambassador to the US, Mr. Ransou, recently remarked that there were no Ebola cases reported in South Africa, and the country is 3,000 miles from the nearest outbreak, much further, I must say, than New York is from the area. He remarked, ironically, it's not the epidemic of Ebola that is a problem for him in terms of South Africa. It is the epidemic of ignorance that is the problem. The fear-mongering about the disease threatens to reverse decades of progress for Africa's image. Naive perceptions about Africa have resurfaced. Ebola has brought back the fears and fantasies about Africa. We have also learned that Ebola affects everything, as the provost mentioned: jobs, food production, people keep away from fields and markets. So to lead us in this discussion, as has been mentioned, we have four eminently qualified persons to speak on this subject. Each panelist will speak for 20 minutes, and then we'll open up the discussion to the audience. I'd like to introduce the four panelists. The first speaker will be Professor Chinua Akukwe. He's a professor of global preventive and community health at George Washington University School of Public Health and Health Sciences. I think I'll leave the rest of his bio, as you have the bio with you. Extensive experience with the subject at hand. And then after him, the next speaker will be Professor Nathiel Huppert. He's a primary care physician and a researcher in public health response logistics at Weill Cornell Medical College in New York. And after him, he'll be followed by Mr. John Panzer. He is senior sector manager of the World Bank in the International Trade Department. And last but not least will be Professor Nick van der Waal from the Department of Government Department at Cornell University. So I invite the first speaker, Professor Akukwe, to give us his presentation.
Thanks. Good evening, everybody. Good evening, everybody. See, I came all the way from Washington, you know, did a red eye this morning. So you should pardon me if I need to hear that you guys are awake with me. You know, the good thing about being the third or fourth speaker is that Muna and Fred has already said a lot of what I had wanted to say. So what I'm going to do is simply, in the interest of time, to rush through, make some key highlights about Ebola. If you look at this slide, whatever numbers that you've had, 13,000, 4,800 deaths, just remember that they represent only about one-third of actual cases. Both WHO and CDC confirmed that whatever we are talking about today, we are simply discussing less than one-third of cases. A lot of individuals living with Ebola are not known to the system in Liberia, Guinea, and Sierra Leone. The other thing is that any city with an international airport is at the risk of imported Ebola. This is from WHO. And then finally, the issue of there is no known care. Because this is what everybody keeps asking me, especially when I address predominantly African-American or African audience. Is there any discrimination? Since I left medical school nearly 30 years ago and up to today, there's no known cure for Ebola, except, you know, it's more of a supportive clinical care. Why is the current epidemic so different? This is a very common thing, question that I get. The first thing is that for the first time in my living memory, getting involved in public health, an infection or an outbreak was going on for nearly 4 months, and it was not detected either by national authorities or by WHO. The other thing is that more than 300 Ebola cases are linked to the funeral of a single infected traditional healer in Sierra Leone. In fact, most people believe that more than 50% of current infection today are traceable to this funeral for this prominent traditional ruler. The other thing is that for the first time, instead of outbreaks around the edges of tropical rainforest, you now have outbreaks in congested urban centers and slums. And that's one of the reasons why Liberia is particularly hard hit. Because the slum, I used to think that slums were bad in Nigeria or Kenya, but the one in Liberia, you cannot describe it. It's indescribable. The other thing is that this is the first time that a lot of healthcare workers have been infected, and more than half of them have died. Never used to happen in previous epidemics for various reasons. Then the final thing is that for some reason that I still don't understand, citizens of Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea did not believe or respond to frantic calls or messages from their government about how to avoid contracting Ebola. Some people have speculated that this is a symptom of a disconnect between governments in these three countries and their target population, because it took them more than 6, 7, 8 weeks to really understand that we have a serious problem. Then what are we hearing now from those in the three affected countries, from WHO, from CDC? There are signs that it's beginning to slow down. But I know I was telling Jackie outside that I'm not sure whether it's slowing down, because there are a lot of people that are not known to the system. But WHO and CDC says that it's slowing down. And then, of course, the mass Ebola epidemic and hysteria is beginning to die down. I remember last week during the congressional elections, I had different names for Ebola, depending on which part of the United States. I had Ebola, 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 depending on whichever accent that, because people running for congressional elections, they were talking about Ebola. So it appears, at least this week, that the mass hysteria and the epidemic in US and Europe is slowing down. And then, of course, there's more emphatic international response. And something that has gratified many of us working in Africa is that Africans are beginning to respond. 2 days ago, the Africa Union announced that they will be setting up an Ebola fund of more than $750 million, mostly funded by African businesses. What are the significant challenges? And this is, for me, is the take-home message of what I'm talking about this evening. The six C's that have always plagued healthcare systems in Africa are now more magnified with Ebola. There's a problem of coordination, collaboration, clinical care, contact tracing, who will pay for cost of operations, and how do you connect with at-risk populations. And the other big elephant in the room is, how do you keep the rest of Africa Ebola free? We're talking about these three countries. You have Ivory Coast, you have Nigeria, you have South Africa, and so on. How do you, Kenya, how do you keep them from having Ebola? The other thing, and this is what I had spoken about when I gave my testimony in the Congress, is that we are talking about Ebola because there is virtually no healthcare system in the three countries. And there is no hope that in the next 5 years, you're going to have any reasonable healthcare system in those countries. So part of a significant challenge is, how do you rebuild healthcare systems in Africa? Then the hard-hit countries, the three hard-hit countries, despite the personal integrity of their top political leaders, we know that they are facing trouble because of Ebola. And one of the things that a lot of people are speculating is that once the Ebola ends, that a lot of citizens of these countries are going to ask for serious change in their level of governance, because they believe that their government has not done enough at this point in time. And I think Professor Muna talked about international stigma, which is something that is becoming a major, major problem. So in concluding, Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone, we don't know what will happen, even at the end of Ebola. That is the truth, if you are in public health. We don't know what will happen. Then the neighboring countries, the rest of Africa, and the entire world, how are you going to make sure that you contain the epidemic in these three countries and eventually end the outbreak? So one of the things that is very, very important is that there's really need to strengthen disease epidemic response mechanisms globally, and also strengthen health systems in Africa. And I think if we do that, that will be the ultimate response to Ebola. Thank you so much.
Thank you. So our next speaker is Professor Happelt.
Thank you. I have no PowerPoint slides, which is kind of strange for a medical doctor, because we typically, you know, I was trained to read my slides to the people who are reading my slides, and I enjoy the opportunity not to do that. So thank you very much for having me here. I want to build off of what you just saw. But first I need to just preface, for those of you who haven't read the bio. So my role, despite being a primary care physician, has actually been since 2008 to provide the federal government with a little bit of interpretive experience in terms of trying to understand what the mathematical modeling community is saying about infectious disease outbreaks. So what does that mean? Well, since 2008, I've worked both with the Centers for Disease Control and now in Washington with an office called the Office of the Assistant Secretary for Preparedness and Response in the very, very small units that try to either develop mathematical models to predict what may happen or to read as they emerge in the scientific literature, the models that other academic groups around the world have been producing to try to make sure that the policymakers in this country have a better picture of what's going on. And I just wanted to take my brief time here, and I'd be happy to change topic if this is not something that is going to be part of the larger discussion. But I wanted to just take a moment to explain the role of modeling in outbreaks like the Ebola, and previously, as many of you remember, the 2009 global pandemic of influenza, because there are really interesting scientific advances that have happened even over the last 10 years that have helped us understand outbreaks like this. But there are also huge challenges in the use of these models and in the interplay between academic groups that make the models, the policymakers who have to interpret them, and then the reality on the ground, which is often, in this case, literally thousands of miles away, but often worlds away from the graduate students and the mathematicians who are hard at work trying to understand something in a very theoretical perspective. So, as many of you know, the big week for mathematical modeling in this outbreak was the week when the Centers for Disease Control released its Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report that said, first, that the maximum number of cases could be 1.4 million by January. And second, that if we could achieve 70% isolation of cases, that we would have a very different picture on the ground, a much more favorable and potentially more containable picture. So this really took fire, and it absolutely dominated the press coverage. The same week, the World Health Organization group released a very critical paper in the New England Journal, which is essentially the most prominent medical journal in the world, where they very carefully laid out the results of weeks of study of several hundred cases and refrained from making a projection too far in the future. So I've got some colleagues in the audience who I would like to acknowledge. Peter Jackson is the head of the systems dynamics program at the Operations Research School, and his graduate student, Claire Zellner, who's working with us on these issues. So Peter and I were just looking at those New England Journal slides again today, and what you see is that they give confidence bounds on their estimate of what will happen even a couple of weeks into the future that essentially go from here to here. And what that means is we have no confidence in where this is going to go, which is a very honest thing to say, but doesn't play well in the media, frankly. It's much more dramatic to make a statement about a big number and then try to back that up. Now, what does this mean? Well, this means that policymakers were faced with a serious conundrum because the science didn't really help at that point. And we could go into many reasons why the science didn't help. Part of it, as was mentioned, is that it's very difficult to get a lot of data out of parts of the three countries where the epidemic is going on. So for example, just getting back to this critical issue of, is it on the downturn or is it on the upturn? One of the things that people have seen in the newspapers is that there are large treatment facilities that were just built in a rush that are partly empty in areas in Monserrato County, around Monrovia. And it's easy to interpret this in many different ways. One way would be that there's a downturn in cases. The other way is that because it was a severe rainy season, that patients who were coming into the main part of the populated area of Monserrato County are not traveling because they can't travel. So these are problems that are very difficult to translate into projections. And yet, what models have been used for is making these large-scale projections and then attempting to modify the large-scale projection. What we've been working on is the issue of how many beds are required. So this is one of the things that a couple of faculty at operations research here at Cornell and I have been working on. And that's a very tricky thing to try to get a handle on, partly because what drives the number of beds that are required? Well, the number of cases. And we are unclear about how many cases are actually going to appear in the coming weeks, months, and certainly over the course of the next year. So we're stuck in that, on the one hand, we rely on data that may not accurately represent what's going on the ground. On the other hand, and this is from my particular perspective as someone who tries to translate these models for federal policymakers, there is a need to stand up in front of the cameras and make a decision about what this government or other governments will do. And that need doesn't go away even if the data is poor and the modelers say, we're not really sure. So into that potential void, you get a lot of modelers who use a certain amount of data and come up with a projection and then try to defend that projection. And some modelers who stay quiet during this time and wait for more information to come. But the latter group, even though they might be more scientifically appropriate, don't really help the policymakers who have to make decisions. So what we're faced with is a very complex situation in which the decisions that are made then are looked at several weeks or months after they're made in light of the new data. And so now we can look back and say, somehow we made a decision to establish 17 100-bed hospitals, we being the United States government, the Department of Defense. That rolled out very slowly because of logistical concerns. And right now, this week, we've actually opened up one 25-bed unit in Monrovia that's designed to treat infected healthcare workers. As was mentioned, healthcare workers have borne a tremendous brunt in this outbreak. The other 17 facilities are partially under construction. Some are still planned. And actually, you can go to various websites now and see where they're going to be created. There is, I think, a legitimate question of whether they'll serve the purpose that they were designed to meet, which is to accept an overwhelming number of cases that were projected very early on in the epidemic. If they weren't, then we're faced with a very interesting issue. Can this huge investment in healthcare infrastructure actually serve to help to recreate the healthcare infrastructure that was destroyed during the civil wars in two of these nations? And can it also be integrated into the routine healthcare provided in those countries and in those regions? I am not sure that those were considerations that were really given a lot of thought when the decision was made to create these. So this highlights a very interesting logistical problem, which is that the urgency with which the logistical decision was made was not pushed forward by the pre-existing, and some would argue even more overwhelming, health needs of these three countries, which predated the Ebola outbreak. It was pushed forward by the acuteness of the Ebola outbreak and by the WHO declaration of emergency and by the sense of threat that this seemed to pose to the rest of the world. Eventually, the Ebola outbreak will be brought under control. And then the question is, how does this large investment actually become a long-term investment? So perhaps we can come back to that later. So let me just stop my comments there and pass the mic along.
Thank you. So
our next speaker is Jeremy Benzer. Yeah.
Thank you. Good afternoon. I don't have a PowerPoint, but I want to stand because I'm very short. If I sit there, I cannot see you, and especially if I put you to sleep, I don't know that I'm doing that. So this way I can calibrate my presentation. So my name is John Panzer. I'm a director in the macro and fiscal management global practice of the World Bank. Part of my work covers Africa. And as you may know, the World Bank has been quite engaged and involved in Ebola, but not only on the health side, but also on trying to assess the economic impact and help countries address those. So my presentation is going to focus on that, on the economic impact of Ebola, and to some extent on the social impact as well. By economic impact, we mean principally the effects on productive activity, incomes of the people, poverty, and on government finances. Of course, this is not to say that we are heartless economists and that this takes preeminence over the tragedy of death and human toll that is taking place in these countries. But of course, if these countries and these societies are to move forward from this tragedy, addressing the economic impact is essential and is of the highest magnitude. When thinking about this, I think it's good to think a little bit of put in perspective what are these countries and where are they coming from? Sierra Leone, Liberia, and Guinea are some of the poorest countries in the world. If you look at a ranking of income per capita, and our latest data ranks 189 countries in the world, these three countries rank 166, 174, 184. I mean, it's the bottom, it's the poorest of the poor. If you look at the United Nations Human Development Index that takes into consideration other aspects that are broader than income per capita, out of 191 countries in the world ranked, they are 179, 183, 187. So these are countries that are extremely poor and extremely fragile, and I'm sure our professor that will follow me will be able to link some of that with what is actually happening and why is the first time we see a crisis of this magnitude develop. At the same time that these countries are very poor, they were in a very positive trajectory. After years of civil war and very prolonged dictatorships in some of these countries, they're coming forward. They have been able to stabilize their economies, attract quite a bit of foreign direct investment, granted a lot of it, most of it for mining, but also some for commercial agriculture, large scale projects to generate electricity and sell them regionally. So these countries were really moving in the right direction, growing at very fast rates, mostly because of the rebound from the years of civil war and because of very strong foreign direct investments. And even in a country like Sierra Leone, they were expecting that income per capita could double over the next 7 years. They were growing at more than 15% per year before this crisis hit them. There were also some improvement in governance. I don't want to oversell that. There are huge challenges there. But there were some improvement in governance, and you can see, for example, that tax collection, which is one area one can use, tax collections as a proportion of the size of the economy had been consistently growing, and they do not fall way behind what you see in other countries that are also poor but have better developed governance systems that they had. So this Ebola crisis hit them probably at it's never a good moment, but probably at the worst possible moment as these countries were coming out from these years of crisis, and its costs have been enormous. A lot of when you see numbers in the press, if you care to see them, sometimes these numbers don't look so big because these economies are very small. Professor Ndulu said, I think it was him who said that the population of these countries is 20 million. Well, that's say 15 times lower than the population of the United States. Say it's 300 million or something. But the combined size of these economies is more than 1,000 times lower, smaller than the size of the economy of the United States. So that gives you a sense. And the economic cost has been huge because Ebola has caused what we call aversion behavior. And aversion behavior is this fear of association because of fear of contagion. So normally when you have, when you try to measure the health cost of a health crisis, a lot of people measure it through, say, the cost of the healthcare, the cost of the productivity of the labor loss from people that do not go into the labor market because they are sick, or the cost that is imposed on them because imposed on society because families of these people cannot go to work. But this is much different. This is just fear of association because of fear of contagion, which leads people to not go to the workplace. It leads farmers not to go sow the land. It makes small businesses close. It makes people fear to associate in markets, and it makes, for example, those that provide transportation be fearful that they can get contagion. And therefore, this aversion behavior brings practically the economy to a halt. We monitor data in these countries. We're lucky enough that the World Bank has offices and economies working in all these countries. And in Liberia, for example, in the month of August, cement sales dropped by 60% compared to the same month in previous years. And cement is a great indicator of economic activity. Petrol and diesel sales fell by almost the same amount, between 40 and 50% during the same period of time. Data is very hard to get, so we've also faced the same problems that you face on trying to model the epidemiology. What you're trying to model on the economic side. But we've done our best, and the numbers are staggering. Let me say a couple of little anecdotal things. One, we're kind of lucky in the sense that the World Bank was conducting with the government a household survey at the beginning of 2014, and we had been able to interview about 4,000 people. Of those 4,000 people, 2,400 had cell phones. So during the month of October, we tried to contact all those 2,400 people, call them, to ask them how they were doing after Ebola. And we only managed to get a hold of 650 of them. So it's not a very representative sample, so people are very wary that I say anything about this. But to give you an idea, for those that work in agriculture, 25% were no longer working in agriculture, but at the same time, 66% of those 25% said that somebody in their family was still working. Of those that are self-employed, and this is very important because in these very poor countries, informality is very large, and a lot of entrepreneurial activity takes place through self-employment, you know, and 56% of businesses, of those that declare themselves self-employed, and they're tiny, tiny, tiny business people, were no longer operating. These, plus the data we have on cement sales, petrol, our interviews with the hotels, and so forth, have allowed us to make quite decent, I think, estimates for the economic impact of Ebola for this particular year. And for this particular year, 2014, considering that the impact will only take place for half of the year, since the first half of the year was fine. The results are staggering. Basically, these economies will have half or more, at most, they will have half the rates of economic growth they would have had this Ebola crisis not taking place. So to give you an example, in Liberia, had this crisis not taking place, we were expecting Liberia's economy to grow at 6% this year, 2014. Now, I think that it's going to be lucky if the economy grows at 1.5% during 2014. Considering that the economy was growing at a rate of 6% during the first half of the year, you can imagine the size of the contraction that is happening now in order to bring this down. This has enormous implications, not only on the ability of people to work and have jobs and so forth, but also on the ability of governments to function and provide services. When your economy contracts at this magnitude, you cannot collect taxes because the economic activity is depressed, let alone that it's hard to do it. And at the same time, these governments have faced enormous demands and pressures and needs to increase expenditures, not only in health, but in security, quarantine, hazard pays for health workers, death benefits for health workers' family, and so forth. The fiscal impact that these countries are facing is huge, and it's growing. Our latest estimate, the World Bank issued I think it's the only publication with numbers that's out there at the beginning of October. And at that time, we were expecting that the fiscal impact in these countries would be about 5% of GDP. That means 5% of the goods and service, that's a size equivalent to 5% of the size of the whole economy, goods and service produced this year. This is as large as all the foreign aid that is coming to this country. So this crisis had created a fiscal impact that is at least as large as all the foreign aid that was expected to come to this country. If something like this would happen in the United States, we would be talking about fiscal impact in the order of $700-800 billion. It would be something unthinkable of. And this is what these countries proportionally are facing. Have we seen the worst? I mean, I think that's a very interesting question, which of course I do not have the answer. But what we see is that in the domestic economy, things are starting to stabilize. I think somebody calls this habituation. I mean, initially, okay, you're not going to go to the field, you might get the disease, it's unsafe, but eventually you have to make ends meet, and people are learning to live with this situation. And we see it in some very clear economic indicators. For example, gasoline sales are back to their initial levels, although diesel isn't. We think diesel is still low because a lot of large projects are not taking place. What has maintained these economies besides this habituation of the local of the population has been also that some large foreign investments are still going on. Mining is holding up, some large plantation and agriculture is holding up. What is not happening is that all investments that were taking place, though, basically have been stopped as foreign workers don't come to these countries. So the bottom line is that we see that there's some habituation, there's some stabilization of the situation, and of course the hope is that if this crisis is contained in the next 3 months or next 6 months, then you can have a real rebound of the economy because there are some underlying strengths that we see there still happening. Regional impacts, I think that's a very, very big concern. I mean, these countries are small, their economies are small, they're 20 million people. West Africa, as Professor said, West Africa has a much larger population and an economy of 700 billion people. Nigeria alone has an economy of $500 billion a year. These countries altogether have an economy of $14 billion a year. So any expansion of this crisis to larger countries and countries with larger economies would frankly be catastrophic. So far, we haven't seen that. And despite the fact that there's also a lot of pressures for us to come and say, what is the regional impact? Give us the numbers. We hear that Chinese tourists are not going to South Africa. Frankly, so far, the impact is limited because we don't see aversion behavior in any of the neighboring countries. And the little aversion behavior that you see is from foreigners that are scared to travel to these countries for tourism, but none of these countries have a tourism industry to start with. So our expectation, our hope, it's not our expectation, our hope is that the countries and the international community can help bring this crisis to an end in the next 3 or 4 months. If that doesn't happen, and the numbers roll out, and we don't know what band will be, but it could be from 100,000 to, they say, millions, whatever it is, if it's large enough, it's very hard to think that the Ebola will not propagate to neighboring countries. It's very, very difficult to imagine that scenario. And in that scenario, and if aversion behavior takes place, we can estimate very, very large economic losses for the West Africa region. I'm not even talking about the rest of Africa. So to conclude, a couple of things. First, the economic and social cost of Ebola in these three countries are enormous, yet they still pale in comparison with what could happen if this crisis is not brought to an end in the next 3 months. There's a lot of work to be done if the crisis is contained to rebuild confidence and security in this country, provide financing to businesses that have been decapitalized and devastated, safety nets that those impoverished, and support to governments so they can go back to the business of providing services to their people and keep on the improvement path that they were at. So that's the task ahead. Thank you.
Thank you. So our next speaker is Professor Nick van der Waal.
Well, thank you, and thank you all for coming. And thank you to the Einaudi Center and the Institute of African Development for organizing this event, for which there was obviously an unmet demand. I was at one of the faculty meetings to talk about this kind of programming, and there were several questions in the room at the time about whether there was demand on campus for something on public health issues in Africa, and I think your testimony to the fact that there is. So when I first started to think about what I wanted to say today, I Googled the political effect of Ebola, and I think the first 50 stories in the news part of Google that emerged were all focused on the U.S. and on the effect of the epidemic on the U.S. election. Amuna suggests I should talk about the political implications of the crisis since I'm a political scientist, and I don't want to talk about the political implications on the U.S., and I will resist talking about the U.S. election. But to start out, I think the sort of fear-mongering and ill-informed hysteria that's been in this campaign season, a hallmark of the U.S. reaction, does have implications for politics within Africa, as I will suggest. No doubt, much of Africa, and not at all just Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea. I 2 weeks ago, I was at a conference in South Africa, and I can tell you that since I've come back, 4 or 5 people have recoiled from me when they found out I was. And I said, look, South Africa is far away from where the epidemic is. But so I think this epidemic of fear has not contaminated Western Europe nearly as much. But I don't think there's any doubt that there will be fewer tourists, more obstacles for citizens of all of Africa to come to the US, and probably some long-term damage to the sort of reputation of Africa that is deplorable, but it seems to me almost inevitable. Okay, so how does one think of the political implications? Well, the first thing to say is that it's very hard to say because, as the previous speakers have suggested, we really don't know where this epidemic will go. And as a political scientist, I really don't have much of a take on that. Although, as I will suggest, I think one can make probably political science-y kind of predictions. The first place I think to start is to look at the AIDS epidemic. And there was a kind of cottage industry of articles in the political science literature about what the AIDS epidemic would do to Southern Africa. And the logic of this literature was basically that the epidemic would shorten the time horizons of citizens who would be much more likely to tolerate risk and to tolerate risky behavior. And this was widely viewed as increasing the risks of political instability in the region. I don't think this literature reads very well a decade later, frankly. It seems a bit hysterical. And on the whole, the AIDS epidemic did not have dramatic political effects on how politics is practiced in Southern Africa. And this is in part because societies, African societies, just as all societies, are pretty resilient, and the historical legacies that create how countries do politics are pretty strong, and it takes more than just a little epidemic to really upset them. I think there are some interesting lessons from the AIDS epidemic, and the first one I would suggest is that the nature of the illness affects the nature of the politics around that illness. Let me give you one example. The key thing about AIDS, and the key way in which it's really different from Ebola, was the very long dormant period of the disease. So people could walk around for 10 years not knowing that they had AIDS. Okay, they could walk around for a long time not knowing that they had AIDS, and then they could know they were HIV positive, but not be symptomatic for many, many years. Okay, and that very much shaped the response and the politics around AIDS. Among other things, in countries like Southern Africa, HIV positive citizens became one of the best organized and vocal lobby for public health efforts. Okay? I suspect that if you find out that you have Ebola, the last thing on your mind will be to look for other Ebola sufferers and organize an NGO. You know, and so I think that's fundamentally a real difference about the disease. I think also it fundamentally is why I do not think we will reach the kinds of numbers for Ebola that existed for AIDS, in which the fact that there was this long dormant period meant that it was very, very much harder to stop the disease before, in some cases, a third of the adult population was affected. The other thing is that pretty quickly there was a treatment for HIV/AIDS that would maybe not solve the disease completely, but would keep it at bay, okay? And that meant that there was a real premium and a real debate about what to do in terms of public health terms. I would argue that the primary public health discussion around Ebola now is there's a long-term strategy to maybe develop a vaccine or effective medicines, but the main strategy is one of containment. And that, too, I think will shape the politics and the course of the disease. Okay. So let me say basically two general categories of political effects that one can talk about. One is the last speaker spoke about the economic effect and suggested that there is a dramatic economic effect. Let me go further and hear another difference with the AIDS epidemic. Southern Africa has much stronger state structures, much stronger public health systems, much more literate populations, more urban populations, and on the whole, much more legitimate political systems. Botswana is a democracy. South Africa is a democracy. Botswana is a long-standing democracy. South Africa has probably the strongest political institutions on the continent. West Africa, on the other hand, is a region tottering on the edges of chaos and has been for a long time. Now, one hesitates to generalize about a region that encompasses 20-odd countries and is probably larger than the continental U.S. But nonetheless... We these countries that were hit directly were just coming out of civil war. The Central African Republic is in the process of falling into civil war. There's a very precarious situation in Mali right now. Burkina Faso has just had a military coup. Niger has had a succession of coups in recent years. There's a Islamic threat in the region. that has destabilized states. Several states in the region have been really gangrened by the international trade of drugs, with state officials being clearly bought by the Latin American cartels, and so on. So it is the weakest region, sub-region in Africa with the highest risk of political instability. And it's hard to think, and let me also add that the price of oil is collapsing, and the rosy numbers of the last decade for the region are in part due to these high oil numbers, which are now going to decline in something like 8 or 9 countries of the region. So I think that the economic shock will be quite severe. And these are not politically stable countries for the most part. Okay. So I think that does have political implications. Secondly, and here is I don't want to talk too long, but the role of the state. The epidemic is in a very real sense a political failure, since it highlights really the failure of these states to provide decent health to their citizens and to be responsive in a public health manner to this kind of crisis. Now, there are a couple ways of thinking about the implications of this for politics and in the long term. The comment I've just made about the sub-region suggests that this may affect the political legitimacy of regimes in the region, where there's a real cleavage between a state elite which has been very complacent about spending on social services and has very often viewed social services such as health as something that donors do, but that is not a core function of government. And it's very clear from public protests all over the region that states don't have much legitimacy. This could further weaken that legitimacy, as I've just said. Secondly, we see that the epidemic has already been used by several governments, most notably the government of Liberia, to limit political freedoms. So Liberia has imposed a press ban. Now, the government's argument was that the press is sometimes irresponsible about with rumors and stuff like that, and I can vouch for the irresponsibility of the West African press. But still, it's scary when governments start to do that. Governments are likely to be less forthright and more repressive to certain marginal populations. We haven't really talked about the gender dimension of this epidemic, but my sense is that more women than men have been affected by it. Something like 60% of the victims have been women. And one can assume that as governments decide who they're going to treat and what kind of strategies that they're going to pursue, that more marginal, weaker elements of society are almost necessarily going to be affected more adversely. And I think it's too bad we haven't really seen much on the gender dimension. I think we should see more. Thirdly, on this sort of how this affects the state, is that we've seen really the emergence of an NGO sector. It's really striking how the heroes of a lot of the stories about reaction to the crisis have neither been the donors. WHO has really taken a pounding in terms of bad publicity, and it's not been the governments. Ellen Sirleaf Johnson, no longer seems like the kind of heroine that she'd become in the eyes of a lot of the Western press. On the other hand, Doctors Without Borders has emerged as, you know, its reputation, if anything, enhanced by this crisis. Now, finally, to end on a positive light, is the long-term optimistic view, which I would call the Charles Tilly view. Now, for some of you who don't know, Charles Tilly was a historian who famously said the state made war and war made the state, talking about Western Europe. And his argument was that external threats and threats to the state had strengthened the state throughout history. and that the strong states of central of Western Europe had emerged thanks to years of conflict. Now, of course, you know, that this is also how the 1,000 or so little kingdoms that existed at the end of the Roman Empire became 50 states. The other 950 disappeared. But this war process was good for the state. And this has been used in the recent past to say that external threats and internal threats are actually good for states because they rise to the challenge and they increase their capacities. I think this is probably true in Southern Africa, that the threat of AIDS, I don't know, I would say it strengthened the state, but it certainly strengthened the ability of the state to do public health. And so maybe in the long run, this is the jolt that these very relatively complacent West African governments will need to build up capacity to provide better services to their citizens. And I'll stop on that hopeful note. Thank you.
Thank you very much to our panelists. I think you agree with me that they've tackled all the aspects of the problem, the political aspect, health, and economic. So now we invite the participation of the audience, questions or comments. Yes, please.
I enjoyed the presentation very much. I think we've learned a lot. One thing that I have been missing, that I have not heard from the panelists, is what lessons, if any, can we get from this episode? And if I read the press, WHO maintained that they could have done a much better job had it been for greater support over time from the donors, in particular the U.S. had not been paid. Again, I don't know the extent to which this is correct or not, but it seems to me that we have to learn from this terrible episode, and we have the world community has to be much better prepared in the future to contain such an epidemic at the outset. And I was wondering if the panelists did have some suggestions about how to better prepare ourselves to find such an epidemic early on and contain it.
I think I'll ask you to also have at least three questions. Yes, please.
My name is Yafa, and I want to say that I'm from Liberia. I guess I'm from Liberia. I was there when the situation started. And every day I stay here, I'm involved with the situation back home because I'm a committed leader of about 5,000 residents. So that required that every day I have to be in touch. And I want to say thanks to the panelists for the discussion. I want to say thanks to the IAB for organizing the discussions. Because I think, firstly, what it's going to achieve is that it allows people who see Ebola or who think that Africa is like a side of our healthcare boss to see another way. But I had a couple of disappointments from whom the facts are provided, because many of those information I think quite does represent the actual situation on the ground. For example, we try to attribute the situation in Liberia maybe to the presence of swamp communities, and I think the data are available, the community that were targeted, or the communities in which many persons got in the affected with Ebola were not strong communities. There was one situation of a strong community which is West Point that were quarantined that was done all of us to be able to be part of the government. I'll do my best. We have Florida, we have Utah, we have West Point, we have many other places. Western was affected. I mean, let's say we're currently for close to 3 days. The next one is, Ebola, the way people live in Liberia, Guinea, and so on, and the way people live in America.
Could you get to the question, please, because we're involved?
Yeah, you know, I know we've got a little more, because if people come and create a situation and make other people to appear that they are, you know, they don't know anything, we have to try to provide some minimum cases. In Africa and Liberia, people live based on our community and care for each other.
I think I'll cut you now, because we really have limited time, and we need other people to come in. And I think the panel has caught the gist of what you are saying. And please try to be patient with get as many people as possible. Yes, please.
I have two quick questions. The first was just a clarification. When you said that AIDS kind of formed a way or helps the state form their public health response, is that in response to African state or to the U.S. state?
African.
All right. And then the second, a broader question, why does the panel think that this particular hemorrhagic fever has been so devastating to the economy and has a response when there's quite a few other hemorrhagic fevers that have a higher death toll rate and are endemic in Africa?
Okay, so I think we've had three questions. We'll come to the next round. I'll ask the panel to respond.
So thank you for your questions. Let me just take a brief stab at the first question, which is how can we be better prepared? What I tried to allude to was that a lot of the scientific effort to figure out what's going on is very much reactive to the events. We have a large number of academic groups, both here in the United States and around the world, who are funded by the United States government to provide mathematical modeling for outbreaks. What's interesting is that, as some of you probably read, there was a group from Indiana of physicians who went to the JFK hospital in West Africa over a year ago to start a partnership with their emergency department. They wrote about this in the New England Journal, a very moving piece about the head of the emergency department who wound up dying of Ebola. When they asked him over a year ago, after they completed their hazard vulnerability analysis, which is a technical term for trying to figure out what the risks to the operation of the hospital are, and they listed things like intermittent electricity, poor quality of the water, et cetera. When they asked him what he thought the biggest risk to the hospital was, and this was well before the start of the outbreak, he said, I'm worried about an outbreak of a hemorrhagic fever here because we don't have the infrastructure to contain it. So wouldn't it have been interesting if some of those modeling groups had tried thinking about the economic, social, and infrastructural weaknesses around the world and tried a mathematical exercise of putting Ebola down in various vulnerable countries in the world? I'm sure that if that had happened, we would have seen interesting results. Whether those results would have moved us to strengthen the infrastructures that were clearly in need of strengthening, I'm not sure. But I think your point is that we have perhaps new ways of strengthening our preparedness. And from the certain perspective that I look at this, I would absolutely agree with you. I think it'll be a challenge, maybe less of a challenge now, but a challenge to have these groups see those potentially much less attention-grabbing and headline-grabbing approaches be integrated into policymaking.
In terms of, lessons learned, I think that's a very important question. I think there are a couple of lessons that are already learned by everybody. First thing is that the WHO is now reorganizing the way it responds to epidemics. A lot of us have known about problems for over 15 years for various reasons. And I think the second lesson is that national governments, based on what happened in Nigeria and Senegal, where the governments were able to reach their citizens, perhaps for the first time in many, many years. A lot of people are studying to see how was it that the governments of Senegal and Nigeria
we're able to mobilize their citizens to respond. And I think the other thing that we are also learning is that community response, and I think our friend from Liberia has a reasonable point in what he's saying, the importance of strong community response is one of the things that we're also learning. And then, of course, the idea that you need to rebuild health systems. And right now, there is an outbreak of another hemorrhagic fever, Lassa fever, in northern part of Sierra Leone. And another one going on in northern part of Nigeria. So if you don't have a strong health system, you're not able to deal with some of these outbreaks.
Yeah. I would like to put things a little bit in context. And of course, after a crisis like this, the response is you need to strengthen health systems. But the life in these countries, and if you're the Minister of Finance, is very tough. The whole budget of the government of Liberia, including after all the aid that comes into the country, is $500 million a year. Professor here tells me, because I ask him, the budget of this university for 1 year is $3 billion. So your budget at Cornell is six times operating? Or I may be wrong. Just put this in perspective. Yeah.
That includes the medical school.
It includes the medical school, doctor. Okay. So you can imagine, okay, what are we talking about? So the life of a minister of finance is, do I provide electricity so that people can get to work and get out of poverty by being productive? Or do I provide health systems so the probability of an event like this, if it happens, it doesn't wipe out the economy? These are very tough choices. But to answer your question, sir, because I think it's very relevant, we see that in this interconnected world, there are now public bads. So Ebola is a public bad, something that that starts in a rural area between Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone, countries that even I worked 20 years in the World Bank. Until I worked in Africa, I didn't know where exactly they were. A thing that happens in a village there suddenly has implications for the whole world and could have enormous cost. So there's got to be a system in which the world community can address these public bads before they become too costly for everybody. That's good business. The second is, I think we have to develop some mechanisms through which you can very quickly react to it, financial mechanisms. And those are not in place. And I think one lesson from this event is that global leaders will have to get together and decide to set aside some money to address these public bads.
I don't want to repeat anything that's already been said. The question of why this epidemic and why not some other hemorrhagic fever, I think, is a good question. My sense is that this is the first one where very early in the outbreaks, there were cases in cities, and thus it was much harder to contain. But nonetheless, this has been an accident waiting to happen since, as was said, the possibility of such an outbreak. I mean, there have been a dozen Hollywood movies about it in the last 30 years. And I this comes at a time in which health has gotten something like a quarter to a third of all foreign aid to the region. I think the bottom line is that the aid is good for certain things. It for example, it's good at vaccines or but it's not good at creating public health systems, or it hasn't been good so far. And that's, I think, the striking that's the striking implication of this, is just how weak the public health system in Liberia is. He was talking about the size of the budget. I saw recently that Liberia, before this crisis hit, had 55 doctors in the country. Okay.
Yeah. So next round, we have here. Yes, please.
Let's get a student.
You can go first. We take the student first.
I have a comment and a question. To me, I feel like the toll that Ebola has taken in these African countries is symptomatic of the failure of governance in many parts of Africa. And in the case of Nigeria, for instance, there's a lot of the Nigerian government, I believe, is receiving way too much accolades for how they have handled Ebola. I mean, what people are not focusing on is the fact that Ebola got to Nigeria through the first-class cabin. It came through a very affluent man, and so the whole population that was impacted were the affluent, middle class, upper middle class. So it was very easy to contain it. So as Ebola got into Nigeria through the masses, through the land border, it would have been a totally different situation. So I wonder to what extent is a crisis like Ebola should be a way to change the paradigm in terms of the way aid is given to Africa. So instead of giving African government money that we know that they are going to misuse and embezzle, why don't these countries donate infrastructure to the country? So give us hospitals, give us roads, don't give the government money, because it's not going to teach you that to the population.
Okay. So, yes, please. We'll come to all of it. Yes, please.
I have a question on the statistics. I was wondering if there are testing methods used by healthcare workers to diagnose patients, or if diagnosis is on the basis of symptoms alone. Well.
Thank you. Yes, please.
Quickly, two points. The agenda, I'm glad you mentioned it, Nick. I regret that it wasn't addressed properly. Women are the traditional caregivers in health implications. So if you want to have an impact, how do you address the different population? Another point is beside habituation, what is done? I'm from Cote d'Ivoire and I was in West Africa, living in Mozambique. Cote d'Ivoire has borders with Liberia and Guinea, so the expectation was that it would come. I'm not saying that it is safe now, but the point I'm making is that there's no time to elaborate. There are certain things besides habituation. You don't go back to business as usual just because you know, time passes. So what is finally, poor infrastructure, medical infrastructure, it's the responsibility of African government. But there were issues historically. Briefly, Munasore, recently I was in a discussion with an IMF, former IMF officer, who is an African, and who was recalling his own terrible experience as a young, energetic and optimistic, going to Africa, and the IMF team telling the government where they were working to cut, education cut, health cut. So many of the infrastructure in Africa were in decay, even in countries where there was some responsibility, and I disagree with the unique, it's not every West African country. Although you say that, you know, it's easy, difficult to generalize. So the healthcare facilities in Africa were in decay, not only because of the conflict and internal situation, but in part also because of policies of international financial institutions. So I hope you can address those.
Yes, please. We have I think we'll take all the questions because we're running out of time. I didn't get the response. Yes, please.
Well, I had the honor to work in Liberia in 2005. At that time, it was a post-war country with Phyllis. I didn't see a lot of, as Matt mentioned, infrastructure is very, it was very bad, and still is. But I don't know, a lot of international focus on these political things, but it never works. While they have ignored the infrastructure, they have ignored the economy, and I'm wondering why this disease was not contained in the first place when it emerged. Why the focus was not given, when undivided attention was not given at the time that now everybody is out crying.
Mm-hmm. Ali Bak.
Hi, thank you. In the interest of time, I'll make this question quick. My question is for Mr. Van der Waal. So a lot of the questions in this round have been about infrastructure, but back on July 19th of 2012, Jane Quillette, while writing for the New York Times, mentioned mentioned that China had recently invested $20 billion into Africa. So does China necessarily have a greater interest in trying to stop this Ebola outbreak from spreading to the rest of Africa in order to get a return on their investment? And to follow up on this as well, Mr. Kukwe, on slide 5 of your presentation, you say that you don't think that there's any of these African countries that can manage simultaneously to, if there was a gigantic outbreak in the country. But Mr. Panzer, you talk about how these are some of the four poorest countries in the entire world. Now, Mr. Vanderwolf, again, in your presentation, you talk about how war can make countries stronger, but you said sometimes it results in the long run. So will these countries really have a long run to become stronger without having terrorist groups such as Boko Haram come into the country and really take over these governments, seeing their inability to prevent this Ebola outbreak and control its spread?
So any other very, very brief question, because we let the panel respond, and that's it. Very, very brief.
I'm just wondering if there is any cultural aspect or artistic and creative endeavors that the Ebola pandemic has given rise to.
Okay, I think at the very back, you've had your hand for very brief, please.
Okay. In these multiple initiatives that these countries need, have you considered at the micro level the very clear need of feeding these people in these small towns, in these small villages? Because one of the things is that they go and eat bushmeat, and many of these bushmeat was contaminated with it. So, given the crisis, economic crisis, and given the dire need that they hear, if some of these initiatives, if you hear some that is taking into account, how do we stop funding in this site?
Yeah, I think we're giving a chance to everybody. Anybody else? Yes, in. Please.
Just a quick context to our question. The reason I asked about pregnancies, the process of pregnancies, is because from my knowledge, I understand that doctors diagnose based on symptoms alone, and I found that problematic because there are so many diseases in West Africa that have similar symptoms to cholera and malaria, and it's rainy season, which is prime time for these diseases. So if it's not based on testing, then
okay, the last.
Yeah, it is a similar question. We focus on star diseases like HIV/AIDS and Ebola. You tend to neglect traditional diseases, and then you create another vulnerability for the epidemic outbreak.
So I'll let the panel decide which questions they answer, choose the themes.
So let me just give a very brief answer about the diagnosis. And I know this from working with staff at the Kanima General Hospital in Kanima, Sierra Leone. They're in the hospital there, they test for three things. One is malaria, one is Lassa fever, and the other is Ebola. The malaria and Lassa fever tests are rapid tests. The Ebola is a PCR, polymerase chain reaction test, that at the time that I was working closely with them had to be motorcycled over to a lab that wasn't on site. And now there's a lot of activity trying to get on site, essentially labs on a chip. But at no time, at least when I was working with them, were they only making symptomatic diagnoses. And I think that that's pretty much universal throughout the three countries. Mm-hmm. The some of the earliest and most impactful investments were these mobile labs, one from China, one from the Navy, and a couple of others. And UNICEF is now on the ground trying to get better telephonic systems for results coming out of these labs.
Yeah, I want to assure you that I'm not aware of any clinical diagnosis of Ebola. I'm not aware of it, and I haven't seen it. So it's and one of the problems you have in some rural parts of Liberia, Sierra Leone, is they are not able to have these rapid response mechanisms from their laboratory services. And that's why various governments and international agencies are trying to ramp that up. On the issue of governance, we can stay here till end of next week just talking about governance. But we all know that everything in Africa eventually boils down to governance. Gender is very, very important. Gender, especially in Liberia and Sierra Leone, majority of the people dying the caregivers and women. And I understand, it's my understanding that the UN mission now, based in Accra, they are developing a new strategy to make sure that they are able to reach the women who are from the caregivers, family caregivers. Cultural aspects, I'm glad that you mentioned that. Funeral ceremonies is killing people in these three countries. And I remember in Nigeria, once Ebola came to town, even my own tribal area, Igbos, that normally like to bury people, they didn't allow anybody to bring back any corpse from any part of West Africa. So I think eventually every country will have to take very drastic action to make sure that the spread of disease. Finally, on disease response, the failure of Ebola is at the national, local, and international level was a breakdown in disease response mechanism. And we are being assured now that that will not happen again, at least from WHO.
Anyone?
Anyway.
Yeah,
well, I just want to second this point that ultimately it all boils down to governance. There's no other way a country or a society becomes 186 out of 191 in the world in terms of economy or human development if you don't have a severe problem of governance. And it's almost a tautology. So that's the core problem. The issue is this crisis, this Ebola happened in the countries that were probably least prepared to deal with it. And the reality is when you are that poor, it's very hard to provide health, to build health. Building health systems is very complex. It's a lot more difficult than providing a vaccine. It's very complex. It requires a lot of disease that Professor mentioned. And many of these countries are very, very far from that. As to the macro issues of the IMF and so forth, that's a very old narrative, whether true or not. It's certainly not the narrative of today, but ultimately, countries, just like people, need to deal with the resources they have to provide the services. And if somebody gives the bad news, that doesn't mean that person is culprit for that situation.
Yeah, I mean, Ndri, you know, whatever the effect of structural adjustment was in West Africa in the 80s, the truth is that spending and sort of statistics on education and health are considerably better in most of these countries than they were before the onset of structural adjustment. So, it you know, one can imagine an alternative universe in which Africa would have some of these countries like Liberia would not have had civil wars and would have had much more effective investments in public health. But it's hard to think through a counterfactual very, you know, rigorously. I do think, I mean, I did not know that the budget of Liberia was only $500 million. To give you a sense of that, I think that the U.S. last year gave $120 million in foreign aid to Liberia. So I don't know how much of that gets tabulated in the ODA. The point in the aid statistics, the point I would make is that it's clear that there have been real efforts in an area like public health over the course of the last 20 years in many of these countries. But, you know, almost by definition, it has not been a particularly effective effort, albeit it's a very hard environment in which to work. But as someone said, that the aid to Nigeria is often ineffective, and should the modalities, the type of aid that a country like Nigeria gets, should change. I'm not sure, but there is no doubt that your countries are usually better served if they're doing things on their own And if there's the will and the, you know, the desire to solve things like public health. I mean, you don't have to be super rich to say, oh, we only have 50 doctors, we should train more doctors. That's not rocket science, and it doesn't require, you know, billions of dollars in budgets. It requires just a number of scholarships every year, and even the poorest countries in the world could afford that. So I think in general, the situation where you rely on foreign aid for your efforts in an area like public health are generally generally means that you're not going to perform as well as if everything was motivated locally and sort of organically within the society itself.
Well, I think we'll come to the end of our proceedings, so please join me in thanking the panel.